We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the pre-approved tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiracies as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dresser frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiracies redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiracies.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft cock.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
People, you can bitch about the financial elite's elaborate network of manipulation and control and the psychopathic suicide machine we call capitalism, just to remain paralyzed and hypnotized by the fear of falling through the cracks of a rigged game you never had the conviction to demand be evolved. Or, you can get smart and beat the wizards of Wall Street and the demons of the debt-based illusion of scarcity with a little financial magic and sorcery of your own, and today's guest on the Higher Side Chats is the man to help you do just that. A lifelong student of magic and the occult, studying the arts in New Orleans, Nepal, and across Europe, the author of Financial Sorcery, Magical Strategies to Create Real and Lasting Wealth, Jason Miller, how the hell are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Oh, I've never been better. Your book was actually a bit of a wake-up call for me because I spend a lot of time stoned, lost on the internet, listening to everything from whistleblower accounts of occult rituals among secret societies to occult symbolism in Disney movies and the dollar bill itself. And like a lot of people, I'm up on the soapbox saying, hey, look at them, you know, look at what the elite are doing, it's not fair, while I'm being railed by the low end of the totem pole. You know, it seems like there are a lot of powerful people using magic, you know, why shouldn't we? Am I right?
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. In this world, unfortunately, it we are stacked against us as far as attacking the problem from the outside. You know what I mean?
Right.
So unfortunately, the old saying is a little bit true. Money talks and bullshit walks, and you know, you have to be part of the system to change it nowadays.
That is true. You know, I don't have much of a spiritual self, but I admire your dedication to learning and practicing all the occult arts. What are some examples of how you've used them in your own life?
Well, you know, I always tell people that, I've done a lot of ritual. I've summoned spirits. I've done magical rituals for people for all kinds of conceivable reasons. I have, you know, spent time meditating in charnel grounds and doing all kinds of strange things. But the best thing that I practice is just simple meditation. Just spending 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes at night, sitting down, watching the breath, watching the mind for distractions, getting distracted like, you know, every half second, and then bringing myself back to the meditation. I tell you, you know, it is the number one way to develop magical skills. It's the number one way to control your mind. It's the number one way to attain freedom. And once you have that kind of mind control, and the patterns of your own mind start to become apparent as far as, well, where do these thoughts come from? You know, you're your site deals with a lot of things where, you know, you're encountering a system that's stacked against you. I mean,
right.
Not just political things. I mean, you walk into an Abercrombie and Fitch, and you are walking into a place that has been meticulously designed to make you think certain thoughts.
100% agree.
You know, the tiles on the floor when you first walk in are a certain size that tell the mind to walk further in, and then they change as you get deeper in. There are, you know, in the men's section, there's like exposed piping and things like that. It's there purely to make men feel more manly and more likely to spend money. There's the music at a certain volume to drive out mom and dad, but to keep, you know, the juniors in with the credit cards. I mean, it is a masterpiece of psychological manipulation. So with meditation, these kinds of things become apparent because you get to know your own mind. You get to know what thoughts are yours, what thoughts are simply mechanistic reactions, and what are you reacting to.
Right. It seems like such an important first step, but so few people actually put the time in to, you know, benefit from meditation. I mean, I know you say you can't be bad at meditation, but I mean, I just get distracted and I have a hard time just dedicating the time to it, you know, turning the TV off. Who wants to do that?
You'll thank yourself. If you spend a week just doing it for 20 minutes a day, you'll want to go back. It's getting over that first few days. It's kind of like going to the gym. You know, you go once or
another
twice.
Another thing I don't do.
Right. Well, you know, and I never did it. And, you know, you go once or twice and you're kind of like, oh, well, you know, you fall off the wagon. But once you go for like a week or two and you start to feel just a little bit of what it gives you, then all of a sudden it's not a problem wanting to go. The problem is wanting to do it more. And so,
I wish I had that problem.
And, you know, you're not alone. I teach a lot of magicians, witches, and occultists magic. I have my strategic sorcery course. And the number one thing that people report back is, you know, I don't want to meditate. And I get it, you know. I mean, a lot of people, meditation is like an Eastern thing. They want to be standing up. They want to be doing rituals. They want to be saying things. They want spirits to appear. Whereas in meditation, I'm saying, sit down. Don't get up and do ritual. I'm saying, you know, if a goddess appears in front of you while you're meditating, you tell her politely you're meditating and go back to the meditation. So these are, you know, there's a lot of resistance to meditation, but it is like working out. It, you know, you feel better and you feel the effects afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I am a big fan of the stories surrounding the abilities of Buddhist monks in the Himalayas because it's sort of mysterious and there's a lot of unverifiable and outrageous stories. But you've lived in Nepal, and I know you have an interest in those particular monks. Can you tell us any firsthand accounts or what's really going on up there?
Oh, they're there. I mean, there are, I mean, first of all, even some of the guys that live in the cities or just in the monasteries who have a very strong spiritual practice have some amazing powers. You know, I remember going to see Lama Dawa Chodak, and I've seen lots of, you know, card readers and things like this, but I've never had someone pull a name out of the air. You know, and this is a guy in Nepal, literally on the other side of the world. There's, you know, and no one that knew this person's name was with me. There's no conceivable way that he could have done it. And he does this all the time.
Really?
And then, you know, then there are the guys that are up in the caves that are living in retreats, and these are the people where the really amazing things happen. And
that's what I'm hearing.
You know, there are some things that I don't even like to talk about because they just sound hokey when they're coming secondhand. But that's the real stuff of wizards up there. You know, they're putting the time in and they're getting the result in accordance with that time. And, You know, I remember living in Parping, which is outside of Nepal near Dakshin Kali, which is a big Kali temple. But all of a sudden, one morning, we were about to start this Vajrakalaya ritual, which is going to last for 3 days. And all these Nakbas, these Tibetan sorcerers, showed up, and we're all doing this together. And then at the end of 3 days, they're gone. Just like, well, where do these guys live? Oh, they're, you know, they're going back into retreat. They're up in caves, you know. They're not, like, guys that hang around for you to chat with. So, yeah, the real deal is still happening. And, you know, some of the stuff is verifiable. I think it's Cambridge University that was doing studies on Tummo, which is the inner heat yogas. And, you know, they have monks on record getting parts of their body up to 117 degrees using nothing but their breath meditation. So,
what do you think the point of that is?
Well, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people have a mistaken idea that the point of Tummo is to generate heat. And it would make sense in the context of Tibet because, of course, Tibet's very cold.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the famous Repa tradition where, you know, people vow to wear nothing but cotton, like Milarepa. But really, Tummo developed in India, and it developed in quite warm climates. So having done a little bit of Tummo myself, I can tell you that the point of Tummo is not really to generate physical heat. It's part of, similar to Kundalini, you're raising energy up the spine, vital energy that turns the volume up on everything, and then this rises through the body, and then you experience this ascending power which melts, it's said to melt the wisdom drop and cause a descending bliss. And then it's in this state of, you know, bliss and emptiness that you enter into other yogas, like the sex yogas and things like that. So,
right on.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Now, on the subject of your book, Financial Sorcery, you talk about the spirit of energy, or the spirit and the energy of money. Well, like, instead of avoiding it or fighting with it, like I'm sure most people do, how should we change our relationship with it so that it works with us instead of against us? What is the spirit of money like?
Well, you know, I give several qualities of the spirit of money. The spirit of money is related to time, and money doesn't like to be wasted, and so on and so forth. Things like this. Money needs to move to accumulate. A lot of people think in terms of Scrooge McDuck gathering more and more millions to sit in his bank.
Hoarding.
But really, money needs to move to generate even more money. So there are things like that. But our relationship with money, we have to have a positive relationship with money. And it can be hard because we look around and we see people with money behaving reprehensibly. And it's hard to look at that and not see, oh, you know, that's something I want no part of. It's just, you know, evil. And, you know, here's the thing. That take, that spiritual take, that anti-materialistic renunciation take is a good spiritual take if you're really going to do it. So in other words, if you're saying, you know, I don't want to be a part of the system of chasing after money and dealing with money and so on and so forth, that's great. Become a monk. Become a nun. We've got Buddhists or Catholics. Or if you don't want to go that route, then, you know, come down here to New Jersey to Tom Brown's Survival School, and he'll teach you how to live, you know, just on your own with a knife in the woods.
Right. Ready for the collapse.
Right, exactly. And just walk off into the woods and live like a wandering yogi or homeless mystic or something like that. These are all really good ways to go spiritually speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Are you gonna do that?
Right. Yeah. So they're not that practical.
No,
but, I mean,
but that's just it. They're very practical. All you have to do is show up and do it.
Fair.
I mean, really.
But you're sort of cut off from 95% of humanity.
You will be, and that's the point, is mm-hmm. that you can't have what I call barista spirituality. And this is what I had in the 1990s, you know, when 20-somethings, us Generation X people, were all quote-unquote slackers in the 90s. And, you know, we'd like just work our little jobs that we didn't care about, and we'd say, mm-hmm. you know, oh, it's just, I'm doing whatever, it's just to support, you know, my occultism or my music or my poetry or whatever it is that people were into at the time. And, but ultimately, you're still working 40 hours a week.
Right.
And you still need money for this, that, and the other thing. And what happens is, as you get just not even much older, just a little bit older, the sort of bohemian trip starts to get a little old, and mm-hmm. you start to maybe think about, well, if it's old now, what's it going to be like when I'm 70?
I know, and, that's the real killer.
Right, and then, geez, people are living into their hundreds, so when I'm 70, you know, and ostensibly retired, I still might have another 30 years.
I know.
And then it's like, holy crap, what am I going to do with myself?
Right.
So what I'm saying is, if you're going to renounce money, if you're going to renounce finances, then really renounce it. Don't, like, you know,
you can't
work
half-ass
at Starbucks and be like, I'm non-materialistic. Otherwise, your only other option is you have to master it, because money is too powerful to not either renounce it or master it.
Right.
If you don't fully renounce it, it will master you.
Exactly.
And I think if we look around at the world, you see a lot of problems caused by people mastered by their love of money. And
completely agree. I mean, it's no wonder people get so stressed about it on a daily basis. You know, you come home from a job you hate, you can't quite figure out a way around it. You know, I come home and start suckling at the pity titty and numbing myself with a new season of The Office while I point my hatred at the 1%. But, you know, your book brings up a great psychological barrier that people have that causes them to hold themselves back, and that's having a misaligned set point. Can you explain the set point?
Absolutely. The set point is the idea that we have a place where we're comfortable. And it's not necessarily the place that we want to be. It's the place where we think we should be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's deeper than the conscious mind. We can say all we want, you know, well, I would, you know, what I really want is to make, you know, $1 million a year and have a vacation home in the Maldives and so on and so forth. But if we were raised with parents that were sort of, you know, middle class, lower middle class, we tend to have a set point that's comfortable around $40,000 to $50,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's so true.
Right. And then people that are raised in poverty, you know, of course you want out. You want more. But people, you know, you say you want more, but you're comfortable with so mm-hmm. much less. And then people will actually get defensive when people move out. This is why, you know, people that go to school in extremely poor areas often report getting bullied when they try to do their homework. They get bullied when they mm-hmm. are on a trajectory to go to college. You know, it could be a racial thing. It could be just a class thing, but you know, this happens all over.
Right. It's the insecurity that if Joey over there in the front row is doing well, then that means I'm doing bad by comparison, so let me fuck with him so that we're all doing bad so I don't seem that worse off.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's amazing. You know, you can sit there, and if you're kind of used to poverty, then having a job that gives you $25,000 a year might be, you know, right within your set point. Like, I'm doing okay. Mm-hmm. I want more. And you're going to have money problems living in this country at that pay rate, but you're used to those money problems. Mm-hmm. So you don't work like crazy. But if you lose some of that, those all of a sudden, all effort, all stops are off. Every minute of every day is spent getting yourself back to that level.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with sort of middle class. You're looking at like making $50,000 a year or something like that. And if you're, you know, if you're making that and you're like, yeah, we really should make more, we would be able to save more for retirement, we would be able to put more away, we should start a second business to do an income stream, we mm-hmm. could be doing so much more with our lives than we are. And it's all like this idea of what I want, and maybe I'm going after it a little bit, but right. all of a sudden, if you have the rug pulled out from under you, if your job, like, you know, cuts your hours in half or something like that, or you lose your job and all of a sudden you have to live on your unemployment check, then all of a sudden it's a mad dash. Oh my God, the boat is sinking. We have to fix this, get ourselves back up to comfortable place.
Right. X. I mean, people tend to look at ideas like magic and manifesting your own desires with the right intention or willing things. They look at that as new age bullshit, but it is a matter of the set point, because you probably worked real hard and dressed all sharp and pimped the interviews and made sure you passed that ridiculous drug test. You got the job and then you stopped. I mean, I say it all the time. I've watched 5 seasons of Always Sunny in Philadelphia and I wonder why my dreams are dying. You know, you manifested your desire, then you got lazy and bitter. But how can we get out of that set point and manifest something a little more fulfilling?
Well, in the book, I talk about how to move the set point in mm-hmm. stages. You know, the first step is to release yourself from that set point. And I give all these sort of a ritual example of how to, you know, free yourself from that old thinking. And then the next is to prepare to have that set point moved. So you start talking with people at the that already have their set point where you want to have yours.
Mm-hmm.
You start associating with those people. You literally start mimicking some things, dressing like they dress, doing like they do, talking like they talk. I mean, it sounds like you're, you know, some people would say, well, you're not being true to yourself, but all of these things are external. Like, if you think that, you know, because you were raised to talk a certain way and you're changing that now, that you're losing an essential part of yourself, that's a pretty crappy sense of self.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, so you transform yourself into what you want to become, and then you ritually seal that. And then you have to seal it again by actually achieving something at that level. So, you know, my example, my saint for this is Archibald Leach. Do you know who Archibald Leach is?
No, but I like the name.
Archibald Leach was born in 1904, and he was, you know, kind of spoke with a stutter and a Cockney accent, and not poverty, but, you know, not well-to-do either, and did some vaudeville acts and things like that. And when he came to the States, he looked around and, you know, he saw movie stars, and he decided he wanted to be a movie star. And so he worked on changing in his accent. He worked on changing his appearance. He worked on basically inventing a new self. And, you know, taking on the initials CG because he liked Gary Cooper and who was the other one that had the CG?
Clark Gable?
Yes,
Clark Gable. Who didn't like Clark Gable?
You know, he decided to reinvent himself as Cary Grant.
Oh.
And so Archibald Leach transforms himself into Cary Grant. And he even... you know, some people think of them as jokes, but people that are really hip to what he was doing can see that he was sort of you know, enforcing it through a magical act in his movies. Mm-hmm. For instance, in Our Girl Friday, there's a point where he's arguing with the mayor, and he's like, "You can't tell me to do that. The only man who told me I couldn't do that is Archibald Leach, and I slit his throat ear to ear." So he talks about killing his own old persona.
Wow.
In Absinthe and Old Lace, you see where my head's at. Arsenic and Old Lace. He's walking through a graveyard talking with his girlfriend, and one of the gravestones that he walks on is Archibald Leach. So, you know, he keeps reinforcing this idea. And of course, you know, Cary Grant also famously experimented heavily with LSD and so on. So.
Some of the most fascinating people have experimented with LSD. I can't say that I have, but I definitely look up to a lot of people who blow my mind regularly who have.
Well, you know, it's a thing that people have done.
It's
and
one of those
has,
things
you know,
that people do.
It works for some, and it wreaks havoc for others.
That is definitely
know,
true.
No
some of them live on my block. They don't have an address, but they live on my block. But for someone who's, you know, we talked about a little bit about kind of practical things, but for someone who's new to magic and kind of wants to test the waters and see what it brings into their life, what would you recommend as an easy spell or practice that's most likely to yield some type of personal validation to the power of sorcery?
You know, a good one to just start off with that's really easy, that doesn't get you, you know, involved in any kind of real funky spiritual powers, would be a lodestone spell. So you can go to your local Botanica and get a lodestone, or you can order one online, just Google lodestone, get one mm-hmm. from any number of different retailers. And it should be, you know, a fairly large lodestone, not tremendous, but you need large lodestone, and then you need lodestone food. Lodestone food is just iron shavings.
Okay.
So what you then want to do is you want to fill out a petition, and this is simply a paper. And you can make this out, you can, if you're a religious person, you can make it out to God, you can make it out to the goddess, you can make it out to, you know, whatever powers that you feel are there. If not, you can make it out to the universe, to the powers of Earth, whatever your bag is. If you're an atheist, you can just make it out and, you know, just say I'm writing this letter to the universe, because there's plenty of atheist magic, too. So you write this letter, and it basically just details what you want to draw to you. You know, this should be something that is within the realm of possibility, but is not easy necessarily. So, you know, when we're setting our magical goals, we want to look for things that we can work towards. We want to look for things that are not so improbable that it may as well be impossible. And unfortunately, winning Mega Millions really does fall into this category.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, think of things like, you know, getting a promotion or finding that job if you don't have a job, or finding a better job, or, you know, if you take it out of the realm of finances, to, you know, find a lover or so on and so forth. Whatever it is, you want to just write this out. It's my desire to have, possess, blah, 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 or to attain, blah, 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 for my, you know, side business making T-shirts to,
mm-hmm.
You know, double my sales in the next quarter. And you write this petition out, and you fold it up, fold it towards you because you're drawing something towards you, and then just place it on a plate, and then place the lodestone on top of it. And then every day you sprinkle a little bit of the iron filings on it. This is the lodestone food. And you just say, as I feed you, you feed me. Or, you know, as I make this offering to you, please offer me what I, you know, the fulfillment of my requests. And you'll see, you'll start to see things start to fall into place for the things on that petition to happen and
really?
to fall into place. Absolutely.
Now, what's the mechanism there? Why iron?
Well, you know, iron, a lodestone is a magnetic stone. So a lodestone is a natural stone that at some point has been hit with iron, lightning, and it's been magnetized. And so the iron will actually stick to the lodestone, and it'll actually look like little hairs by the time you're done with it. Hmm. So you'll have this sort of metallic chia pet-looking thing after a few weeks.
That's interesting. I mean, and it's tough to know. I mean, because so few people even pay attention to their desires and goals once they reach that comfortable set point right there in the lower middle. So it's hard to know if it's just that just paying attention in general is helping you to manifest it, or if it's the ritual. I mean, in the end, it really doesn't matter if you're getting what you desire. But I think, you know, maybe the ritual just helps you to pay attention on a daily basis and kind of puts it in front of you in a physical form. But that's an interesting thing to try out.
That it does. And remember, this is not just about the lower middle. There are, you know, I have clients, for instance, you know, I mean, I have a lot of clients that contact me for help finding a job or help getting out of debt. But I also have clients that, you know, are already wealthy, and they're contacting me because they want magic to protect, you know, assets that they have, you know, set up. You know, they've decided to put a certain amount of their assets into pure gold that they're going to store in a storehouse in Chile. Hmm. And they want, you know, some kind of spell to make sure that gold doesn't disappear on them. Or, you know, you have people whose set point is already at, like, you know, lawyer, doctor, banker level, because that's, you know, that's how they grew up. That's where they grew up. But maybe they feel an artistic pull. So they want have a set point that's more bohemian because they're not really fulfilled doing what they're doing, and they want to, you know, start making a living as an artist, but maybe they aren't going to be able to live the same way they've been brought up. Well, that's also a challenge to the set point. So it, you know, it can move up or down. Most mm-hmm. of the time we're trying to move it up, but, you know.
Well, I mean, I'll be honest with you. The only way that I've ever tried to test the power of magic or a talisman or, you know, my focused intentions, the only time I've ever tested it is at the blackjack table, and I've had no conclusive results, but tell me why that's a bad test.
Well, you know, the blackjack table and any casino table, first of all, some gambling magic does work, and if you're going to do it, the blackjack table is probably one of the better spots to try it out.
All right.
However, the place is stacked for the house to win.
Of course.
And ultimately, it's a matter of affecting probability. Magic, it does two things. Practical magic does two things pretty well. This is apart from the illuminative magic of spiritual growth and so on. But practical magic does two things pretty well. It alters probability, and that's in direct relation to the power of what you're doing, the gift of the person doing it, and so on. And it can affect the minds of other people. But you have to know which tactic you're taking. So in the case of blackjack, it's a matter of what are my chances to win and how much can I improve them. Now, take me for instance. I have a natural aversion to gambling, and my wife does not. So we went down to New Orleans, and a friend of ours made us a gambling gree-gree bag, which is a type of mojo bag they make in New Orleans. Gree-gree is gray-gray, meaning, you know, a little bit of black magic, a little bit of white magic.
Okay.
So I actually think the term comes from somewhere else, but that's the legend they tell in New Orleans behind the term.
Gotcha.
But, you know, we took it and we went to Harrah's, and I was holding the gree-gree bag, and, you know, I just we do have different gifts, and gambling magic is definitely not one of my gifts. So even with this Grigri bag in my pocket, I still was just not pulling in any money off of these slot machines. And, you know, finally I was like, well, you know, I'm done, because I'm not even having a good time anyway. And I handed my wife the Grigri bag, and as soon as I handed it to her, boom, comes $160. You know, boom, comes another windfall shortly after that. You know, did we walk away with millions or even tens of thousands of dollars? No, but we, you know, walked away with a good bundle.
All right, so that's what I need to
do. There are a lot of factors. Now, in the case of, like, the real long shot things, the lottery, that's something that a lot of people put a lot of time and effort into magically.
Right.
And it's just a waste of time, mm-hmm. because the odds are astronomical that you would win.
And you make a great point about the lottery in the book, which is, like, you know, again, people's criticism. I had an interview with a psychic last week, and it's the same kind of criticism, is that, you know, this kind of stuff either has to be 100% true or 100% bullshit. And if it's true, why can't you win the lottery? And you make the great point that there are millions of people putting their intention and putting their focus and energy into being the winner. So it's not like everybody is dormant and you're there trying to manifest your winnings of the lottery. You're competing against all other millions of types of energy.
Exactly.
And I think that's a reasonable answer for why you can't win it.
Exactly. I mean, apart from that, just, you know, one in something like 180 million as the odds is not not great to begin with. I think, you know, when I was researching the book, one of the researchers that I quoted from had said, you know, you're four times more likely to die in a car accident on the way to buy a ticket as you are to win this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, if you can reduce your chances by 99%, that's still a terrible odds, you know? So,
well, tell me about the idea of, there's a good chunk of the books about offerings. How do you build a relationship with the universe? And how do you give offerings?
Well, you know, there are a lot of traditions where offerings of light, of incense, of food, and so on are a given. And if you're from those traditions, then, you know, obviously you already know how to make offerings, and you can extend them out into other areas beyond that. But for the normal person in, you know, sort of Protestant America that's not really used to offerings and things like that, I tell people to start with either incense or light, or even just rubbing the hands together and offering the warmth, holding them out on a, like, as if you're offering a plate, and then let the warmth sort of drain from your palms. But, you know, the idea behind it is fairly simple. You know, if you think of just people and your interactions with people, you know, you and I have never met before tonight. So
right.
If after the, you know, the phone call was over, you were like, hey, dude, can you loan me $100? I'd probably say no, because we've never met. You know, we
Noted.
Have nothing other than this interview and some common interests between
right.
us. If you asked a coworker, maybe they'd say yes, maybe they'd say no, because you have some history there. You have a
mm-hmm.
shared history. Maybe you've bought her lunch at times in the past and she's reciprocated, or, you know, you've brought in donuts and so on and so forth. But this exchange of goods and services, it doesn't have to be things, it could just be favors. It builds relationship, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then if you ask your best friend, like, you know, dude, can I borrow $100? You know, if your best friend is like my best friend, he would be just whip out $100 and say,
mm-hmm.
like, yeah, here, man. You know, is everything all right? Do you need more money? Is this going to cover you? So that's because you have years of that kind of history of time spent and you know, buying him a soda, paying, right, you know, him buying you movie ticket, things like that. These kinds of things build relationships, which is why when people go out to dinner, rather than divide up the check every time, you know, it's nice for somebody to say, you know, well, we got it this time, and somebody else. It all equals out in the end, unless, you know, somebody's uber wealthy and then hopefully.
So you got to just not ask for things from the universe. You got to build a relationship, make some offerings, and maybe good things will happen.
Exactly. If you go out in the morning and you, you know, you offer, if you don't want to do incense, you know, pour yourself a cup of coffee and pour a cup of coffee for the spirits of the ground. So then you go outside and you offer it to the universe. I like to offer a liquid in the morning like that to the ground and then offer incense smoke to the air. And, you know, you have sort of all your elements covered. You have the material in the liquid, and the liquid itself covers earth and water, and then the fire that lights the incense, and then the clouds of incense itself cover your fire and air. So this is, you know, a good way to make offerings. And you address the beings of your locale. You address the beings of, you know, of
Jupiter,
the entire universe, Jupiter, if you want to get involved in the sort of planetary magic that I adhere to in the book. But yeah, that's how offerings work, essentially. And then, of course, they can get more particular based on what you're doing and whom you're doing.
Right.
To.
One thing you mentioned that was pretty curious to me that I thought was a little weird is that sex can be used as an offering. How does that look as opposed to just regular sex?
Well, you know, this would be something you wouldn't do to, like, you know, local beings that live in the backyard or something like that. But this would be an offering to the divine, the energy from the sex act. You offer it up. You dedicate it, you know, in the way that a book's dedication is an offering to someone. Offerings aren't always material. You know, acts can be material, or acts can be offerings. So in this case, you're offering up, you know, this act, the merit accumulated by this act, the energy accumulated by this act. You're offering it up to gods, goddesses, the powers that be. That's one of them. I think I said, you know, use this mindfully and skillfully.
Right, that's some advanced level.
Yeah, that's
offerings.
One of the more advanced ones.
Well, you know, I really believe that the reality is that most big companies look at customers, employees, and people all the same, which is constantly shower them with empty kindness and shallow praise while trying to give them the shittiest deal possible. So to me, entrepreneurship is really the only way to go, but it is scary. What magic would be helpful for somebody like me?
Well, there are a number of things. In the book, you had mentioned Jupiter, and in the book, of course, I give the glyphs of Jupiter, the set of 16 sigils that's specifically channeled to help in financial magic. So there is a money drawing glyph that you might use to attract capital. Now, you might not be going to a bank for a loan, but you might decide to do something on Kickstarter or something like that to get a project going and accumulate money that way. Or to, you know, do it even more grassroots and just pass it around up on your website. I remember when Randy Mulholland, the illustrator and author of the Something Positive web cartoon, you know, people were complaining, oh, you know, this is supposed to be every day. It's not every day. And he said, well, you know, guys, pony up or shut up. I currently make $35,000 a year. And if you guys donate $35,000, I will quit my job and do this cartoon for the next year. And right. That's exactly what happened. And then as far as I can tell, you know, it just kept going on from there. And he was able to set up advertising and so on. But so you could use your money drawing sigil for that. Then you use your entrepreneurial sigil or glyph to help you navigate, you know, some of the tricky waters. For instance, if you have a day job, then how do you make the time to work on this entrepreneurial venture as a secondary income stream? And then when it gets big, how do you make the jump? This is a, you know, a huge problem for people.
Right.
You know, things are set up to just like do it with their own sweat equity. And then if it gets hopping, then all of a sudden they have no time and they still can't keep up with orders because they also have their day job. But maybe things are not quite good enough for you to just say, hey, I'm bailing on the day job entirely. You know, the owner of FUBU, I can't remember his name now.
Right, Shark Tank, Damon Johnson, I think is his name. Or Damon John?
That's right.
Shark Tank, favorite show.
That's right. He worked as a waiter at Red Lobster. And he would tell stories that, you know, he was regularly having customers coming in wearing his clothes. You know, because his company was that successful, but he was still, you know, he's like, am I really going to quit this job? And of course, everyone from the outside at this point was like, yeah, dude, quit that fucking job.
Exactly.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to use that, language, but, I'm sure. But, you know, yeah, man, quit that job. And of course, finally he did, but, you know, most of our ventures are not going to take off as big as FUBU did. So then it becomes an issue of how do I make that? You might run into issues with, you know, taxes or operating under the table for time. So there's the protection from law. This is nothing shameful. This has a long American history. You know, Sears and Roebuck was started off by the founder, Sears, peddling watches while he was working at the train station. So when people would come in and he would do his job on the platform, he would all of a sudden whip out a tray of, you know, watches that fell off of a truck. And he would then pocket the money, and it was all done under the table. Van Heusen Clothing Company, you know, fairly pricey shirts that you see all over outlet malls and things like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they started in a completely, you know, under the table business with a street cart in Philadelphia. So, you know, you might have that to help you with those issues. So the glyphs, I would turn to the glyphs to make your entrepreneurial visions happen.
Gotcha. And see, I mean, that's the point that I'm at, kind of, is that transition period from day job to, you know, getting my life back. And it is a tough spot, but for someone who may be a little bit earlier on the path, you say that, you know, you mentioned finding your business by performing an invocation to draw an idea to you. But how does someone do that and interpret it correctly?
Well, you know, an invocation to draw your idea for you, we've been talking a little bit about Jupiter, but Mercury is the planet of intelligence and ideas and so on. And, you know, invocations can essentially be like prayers. So you get, you know, you can go online and Google Orphic Hymn to Mercury. And on a Wednesday, which is the day of Mercury, and at sunrise, which is the hour of Mercury, on Wednesdays it is anyway, you get up and you say this Orphic Hymn, and or just, you know, a generalized hymn to the powers of Mercury and intelligence, and you ask for an idea. You know, please send unto me, you know, inspiration for my new business. And not just Mercury, but you can do it on Sunday. The powers of the sun also covers inspiration and, you know, keep doing that kind of thing. And what you then want to do is pay attention to the world around you. You want to pay attention to what people say to you. You want to leave a little time every day, not to spend in meditation, but just to spend sort of in silent, mindless occupation. So like mowing the lawn, driving, mm-hmm. things like that. You ever notice how ideas come to you when you're mowing the lawn or while you're driving? And then you're like, oh man, I got to write that down. And then later when you actually have the ability to write it down, it's gone.
Right.
Well, that's because while your mind is just sort of occupied with a mindless task, it opens itself up. You're not experiencing the discipline of meditation, but you're also not experiencing the occupation of everyday life either.
Yeah, you kind of do have a quiet mind during those activities.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. So, you know, you come up with these great ideas and you know, have a phone with Evernote loaded on so you can just whip it out and record your idea. And then there are other things that you can do. You sit down, you write a list of everything that you like to do, of everything that maybe you can do but you don't necessarily like to do, and then you write a skill list for each of those headings. In other words, I like to practice mixed martial arts. Well, what are the skills involved in mixed martial arts? Okay, so, you know, I do some training, I do this, I do that, you know, I study a little bit of anatomy, blah, 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 whatever it is. And you take a look at those things and start smacking them together. You know, so for instance, I know somebody that is really into astrology, and they came to me and said, you know, I keep trying to get my astrology business off the ground, but it's really hard. There's so many astrologers out there, and I don't know how to, you know, really make myself do this. So I talked to her and I said, well, what else do you love? And she listed a couple things. She said she loves horticulture. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, there you go. I said, there's lots and lots of astrological lore surrounding plants. Why don't you, you know, you can do all kinds of astrology, but specialize in horticulture and take out an ad in a horticulture magazine rather than an astrology magazine. Because you'll be one of 150 names in the astrology magazine, but you'll be the only astrologer in the horticulture magazine.
Touche.
So, and as soon as that happened, then things started rolling. And then people that were into horticulture also tend to be the type of people who might frequent astrologers as well. So they would come to her not only for horticulture questions, but for general horoscopes and things like that as well.
Right on.
You got to find your angle.
Right. Well, what would you say? You kind of touched on this, but what would you say to people, because I think there's probably some of them out there who see this manipulative structure and their time and happiness that they're losing from their job. They decide to quit participating and just try to be happy with a hippie lifestyle without money. It does offer a lot of challenges, but I know some people trying to do that. What advice would you have for them?
Think it through all the way.
Right. It's tough to get back on the wagon.
Well, yeah, it can be tough to get back on the wagon, but think it through all the way. And that's, you know, that's, I think, what people didn't do that came up in the 60s and the 70s and so on. And of course, the occult and the magical and the witchcraft community, you know, has an overabundance of these sort of anti-materialist types, whereas occultism used to be the provenance of, you know, trust fund babies and the well-to-do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it flipped, and in the 50s it became sort of this very bohemian thing to do. So it's tied in with this sort of hippie anti-materialist philosophy that it doesn't necessarily need to be. Mm-hmm. But think about, you know, I would just say, well, okay, how are you really being outside the system. Are you just saying that?
Right. Are you outside of it, or are you just not participating and relying on the people who are participating, who will put in an extra 5 hours a week to give you a little piece of their pie?
Right. Are you, you know, are you not participating by, like, sleeping on people's couches? And 'cause, you know, that's going to get old. Think in terms of your life overall. You know, if you are spending your 20s sort of doing the hippie trip, which is a great time to do the hippie trip, well, then, you know, you might just realize that you might find yourself wanting more later on, and it might be a little late to take on certain tasks, or more difficult to take on certain tasks as you get older. Or, you know, you might find yourself the 40-year-old guy working at the mall, you know.
That's a sad reality for some. I mean, you said it best in that money is too powerful to just ignore. You're going to have to deal with it. So why don't you practice mastery of it rather than just, you know, being subservient to it or trying to live without it when you really can't?
Right. You know, one of the best ways for people that don't want to be, you know, they don't want to be trapped in the system, they don't want to be trapped in the rat race, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Public service. You know, it's a crazy thought because you're working for the government. I mean, that is the system by definition.
Right.
Except where else are you going to get that job security?
Yeah, keep your friends close and your enemies closer.
Right. There is no real rat race in public service. It's not so much of a meritocracy. It's more about how long you've been there.
Mm-hmm.
You are, you know, you have to really, really, really screw up to get fired. You are probably going to get more time off than at almost any private company that you work for. So you'll be starting off with, you know, many more weeks of vacation, many more sick. I mean, you know.
Yeah, use the inefficiency of government to your advantage.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if you have to have a job and you want to be able to go to festivals all summer and things like that, you know, the state job is going to offer you a lot more freedom than the barista job.
Right.
Even though it's ostensibly for the man.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing is that it seems like magic and spirituality, they have a prominent place in almost every society but ours. You know, occult symbolism is in the shadows of our most successful corporations and institutions. It's right in the logos of a lot of them. But do you think it's been weeded out of mainstream culture for a reason?
Well, you know, first of all, there's always an occult side of things that's hidden in whatever culture you're in. So, you know, you can go to India and there's still, you know, if you really talk about Tantra and you talk about hardcore Tantrikas like the sadhus, that's not exactly mainstream culture over there. And we certainly have plenty of, you know, religion and spirituality here. It might not be good spirituality. You know, I'm thinking of like Republican prayer breakfasts and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there. So, you know, it's there overtly, and then there's the covert kind of stuff that is done you know, under the table by some and not by others. Anytime that you say that faith is not enough, I want experience, you fall afoul of both secular materialism, which says there's nothing to experience, so what are you looking for, you weirdo? And you fall afoul of mainstream religion, which says, no, you're supposed to have faith in what I'm telling you. So this is where the faith versus, or pistis versus gnosis versus agnosis comes in, to put it in Greek terms. Pistis would be faith, gnosis would be knowledge, and agnosis technically would be ignorance, but it would be, you know, the acceptance of not being able to know. So we could look at mainstream religion as being a representative of pist. We could look at secular materialists as being representative of agnosis, and then we would look at mystics as being representative of the viewpoint of gnosis.
Mm-hmm. You know, there seems to be finally some global outrage over the unfairness of the monetary system in general, and a desire for change, but also an ignorance about what to fight for. And there's a bit of a media blackout over what's happened in Iceland, but I've heard you talk about it before. Can you kind of clarify what's going on over there?
Well, you know, this is Iceland was one of the first countries to fall, so to speak, in 2008. Their economy, it's not even pretty much. I mean, their economy collapsed. And because, you know, as Forbes magazine put it, you know, they were a hedge fund that issued passports. Right. They were so deeply, deeply involved with the banking system, the shadow banking system, and, you know, derivatives markets, that when it crashed, their country is small enough and their economy was so deeply invested in it that it just went belly up overnight. And of course, you know, we started to follow down that road, and lots of Europe started to follow down that road a little later. But what Iceland did was, rather than protect the people that did it, rather than, you know, protect the shadow banking system, which just sounds like something that, you know, should be the antagonist in a James Bond movie.
Exactly.
Rather than something that, you know, actually exists and is supposed to be okay. They started arresting bankers, and they started telling the world, you know, well, the continent would say, well, you know, you owe our banks, blah, 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 blah. And they say, no, we don't. They're like, no, we don't, because, you know, you essentially fraudulently got us involved in these kinds of things with that, you know, no one had any way of knowing how mismanaged you were making them, and so on. They basically just refused to accept that they owed this money.
Right on.
And, you know, they're a nation. And when you're a nation, you can do things that maybe the individual debtor can't do. And there, lo and behold, their economy is recovering twice as fast as any other European economy.
Yeah, that seems to be the fact. There's a lot of fear, and we're pumped a lot of fear about, you know, we can't let these banks fail. They're too big. You know, everything's going to suck if they fail. We're never going to get out of this mess. But, you know, that's just the people who are scared for themselves telling us, like, hey, you need us. You need us. I promise. I swear you need us. You've always had us. You need us now. Don't get rid of us. And here we are. We don't. But,
yeah,
you know, sometimes I hope, no, I don't want to say I hope for a collapse, but that's really, things got to get a lot worse before they're going to get better.
Well, sadly, I think you're right.
It is,
but
what it is.
You know, you asked about a secondary businesses. Now is a good time to go, you know, open up the first bagel shop in Reykjavik. So,
amen. Well, that about does it, Jason. Thanks for getting deep with me about this. You know, I really recommend Financial Sorcery for anyone who's interested in putting some of this into practice. Where can people keep up with you, and what's your next project? What are you working on?
Well, I am working on a book. This might just be a chat book called Extreme Financial Sorcery.
Wow.
And the, you know, everything in the book is it uses sorcery, so it's not mainstream by definition. But the things that I try to get people to do are more or less normal. Get out of debt, find a job, start a business, be successful, save for retirement, so on and so forth. Not really earth-shattering things in there,
mm-hmm.
As far as, you know, the steps that you take. So in extreme financial sorcery, I apply sorcery to sort of more extreme ways of dealing with that. So if you're in a lot of debt, perhaps it's time to just take a year and make it the worst year of your life, to couch surf, rent free, or, live at parents' house again, or something like that, work two jobs, never go out, never see anybody, just work for a year. And then you wind up with, $40,000, $50,000 bulk at the end of the year that you can pay your debts with. Or say doing something, if you're on the other end of the financial spectrum, things like, the five flags theory, protecting against economic and other types of catastrophic collapse at home, how to get a second passport, how to establish banking in other countries, and so on and so forth, stuff like that.
There you go. The Romney stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Radical. So that kind of thing I'm working on. I'm also working on my second course, which I'm very, very, very late with lessons on right now. But thankfully, I start off courses with some of my more experienced students that are a little patient. So it's the strategic self course. I have already 400 and some odd people in the strategic sorcery course, and that's always going strong with cycles starting every quarter. So now I have my strategic self course that I'm working on, which is a course that focuses on self-transformation.
Nice. And what is your website?
The website is innomanandum.com. That is innomanandum. But you can just Google strategic sorcery and you'll find me.
I was going to say, that's a bit of a branding challenge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm working on that now.
Well, there you have it, people. The very magical Jason Miller. Stop using your will and intention to maintain the status quo and start thinking about how to make money your bitch instead of whoring your life at some corporate job for a few fleeting glimpses of greenbacks. Any last words for the young Padawans, the Higher Side Chats?
No, I want to leave them with your words. That was a great a great way to end the interview. Don't be a slave to money. Make it your bitch.
Boom, there it is. All right. Well, thanks again, Jason. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good one.
You too.
There's another show, people. Keep your pimp hands strong and your ultras clean. Please support THC by picking up a t-shirt from conspiracies.net or voting for me in the podcast awards at podcastawards.com. I'm going for the general category because I don't seem to fit anywhere else. And who goes for general anyway? Exactly. That's my strategic sorcery right there. And it'd be nice to cast a vote this fall that actually matters, wouldn't it? So please, help me out in those ways. If you like the show, playing us out today is Ray Taylor with a little Aladdin remix. The Plight of Aladdin is the name of the track. If you want to see a whole new world yourself, get some financial sorcery in your fucking life. Later, chatters.
Take a carpet ride to a shining, shimmering, splendid place way up in the sky. Just let your heart decide. I can open your eyes, take you higher, wonder by wonder. Look in my eyes as we fly through an endless diamond sky. Take a carpet ride, yeah. We'll be tumbling, soaring, freewheeling, free as a bird in the sky, yeah. I wear my heart with pride. Girl, you open my eyes, yeah. Take you higher, wonder by wonder.